Welcome to Stay in the Loop with Lucy. It is great to be back with you. Now, first question, are you sitting comfortably? And if you are, then we shall begin. Today's interview is with a woman called Kylie, who's going to share with us her experience of having an eating disorder, the process of coming all the way through it. Now, I am very aware that this may be an uncomfortable conversation for some to listen to, for parents, for people with an eating disorder themselves. However, if we can learn from people who've come through the other side, who actually live in a way that that's not part of their life in any way, shape or form anymore, then there's something very special in that. So I'm going to ask you, please, if you can, stay with it, stick it through to the end, and hear the joy in Kylie's voice as she talks about her life now. Without further ado and any more spoilers, here's Kylie. Welcome, Kylie. It is wonderful to have you with us today. It's really difficult to find someone who has experienced disordered eating, and you may, through the process of this interview, share that there was an actual diagnosis of eating disorder, but who also feels and has lived without that label, as in has come through it. So that is a rarity. A lot of people will share that they feel that once they have disordered eating, they will always have disordered eating. So this is why, for me, this interview was just so important, because I felt it was an opportunity to share with parents, with young people, with just anybody in our community, how any of these coping strategies we have do not need to be lifelong labels that we then attach to ourselves. So perhaps we could start with me just handing the floor over to you and you sharing with us whatever you would like to share, to give a background of how it started.
Sure. So it's interesting, as you've just said in the introduction there, Lucy, about how rare it is to come out the other side, as in to have experienced the full-blown ferocity of an eating disorder or disordered eating, and how that can take over your whole life, and then what it looks like and feels like to be on the other side of that. I do remember, you know, once I was still in the midst of it, and having thoughts like, how on earth am I ever going to live without this? How is my life ever going to be free of this? Because I was so consumed, you know, anyone who experiences disordered eating, anyone who's a family member will know that it consumes your every thought, your every movement, every single speck of your day is consumed by whichever way it plays out. So for me, it began, you know, obviously growing up, there were thoughts, there were things there that were always in the background, you know, little thoughts like, ah, oh, there must be something wrong with me, or, oh, if I lost weight, I'm sure, you know, that wouldn't happen, or things would be okay. Of course, there were comments, but mainly it was an internal dialogue that was a reaction, I would say, reaction to what was going on around me in lots of ways. And the lack of self-worth that I had, that I then felt that would be the answer to things. So that was, you know, always like a thread in the background. And it wasn't until I was in my early 20s that it really kicked in. And I would say that it began by, you know, as simple as, you know, dieting that became a bit more extreme. And in my case, also exercise was a big part of it. So things like not only, you know, dieting, restricting the food, but then exercising and then letting that become more extreme, like each day actually exercising more than the day before. You know, I might see that my body, you know, I started to lose weight, I started to feel better, started to get comments, and then that became a little bit more obsessive, you could say, where I then went, great, okay, so the next day I would be eating a little bit less than the day before. The next day I'd be exercising more than the day before. And that continued for a period of months. And it's like the obsession then becomes one of those things that you guard with everything you've got. So, for example, everything was reliant on those eating patterns and the exercise. So if anything tried to interfere with my exercise, I would lose it because I had so much riding on that. And, you know, if, you know, for most part, I could get away with the eating habits in the situation I was in, to the point where I really wasn't eating anything. I was just drinking shots of coffee, and exercising for hours upon hours, and turning every part of my day into exercise. So if I needed to go, at that point I was studying, and I was working, but I was living overseas, so I didn't have family closely around me. I had friends, but I could hide things to a large extent. And if, for example, I was, you know, I needed to go somewhere, I would walk. I would walk from one side of town to the other. I wouldn't, you know, take a bus or what have you. I just saw, yep, great, that's another opportunity for more exercise. And so it became like that. Everything that I did had to become another opportunity for more exercise. And that really continued. If I had to, say, go out for a dinner with friends, if I was in a situation where I couldn't, for the most part, I could avoid it and say I'd already eaten. But if I was in a situation where I couldn't avoid it, then I would obviously eat to, you know, fit the picture, make sure that nobody challenged me. And then afterwards, you know, I'd be purging to get as much out as I could. And the next day I'd be upping the exercise even more. So that gives you a bit of a background. But then, of course, you know, during that period, your body is going through such an extreme, your body's in such an extreme state where you're not only starving, and dealing with the consequence of that, you know, the impact on your thoughts, you know, basically it's a severe depression, but you're just so consumed. Everything is just so consumed and it doesn't feel or seem like there's a way out of that. I remember at night, you know, being in bed and just being freezing, and I couldn't even get comfortable on the bed because all I've got is bones. You know, you're being woken up during the night with hunger pains because your body is literally starving. And so you're going through the physicality of that, and yet at the same time being, you know, having these thoughts, these insistent, consistent thoughts through your head saying, that's not enough. Tomorrow you've got to do more, and this is the next day, and this is the next day, and it's an absolute torment. It's an absolute prison where I felt like there was just no way I could get out of that, because when every day has been set up in a way that you need to lose more weight, everything in your life is configured around losing more weight. And putting on weight was seen as the worst thing in the world, let alone like just stopping losing weight. Putting on weight was just the absolute worst. So everything was designed around avoiding that. So how do you possibly stop these behaviors when that's going to be a given consequence?
I am so pleased that you have gone to the fear and the overriding fear, because what I've heard in what you've shared so far is that, one, it's not logical to a brain that is not being fed those thoughts. And interesting, I always find it really fascinating how food and eating words come when we're talking about the avoidant or the avoidance or the overconsumption of food, that it is about what's going on in your head. You're being fed these thoughts that it is dangerous, and that you are failing in some way if your behavior has not matched the routine that you have set up that you believe has kept you safe.
Yeah, it's difficult to describe. It's like the end of the world. If, you know, I had, for example, there were times where, you know, for example, it's pouring with rain or I had injured my knee and I couldn't go for the run, you know, like I would exercise for literally hours and hours. I'd have my run mapped out. I'd ride to this spot. I'd go walking or running. Then I'd go do this and I'd go do that, everything. And so if there was anything that then interfered with that, I was inconsolable because there was nothing I could do to make up for that. You know, everything was designed around, I have to avoid this point. Everything in my routine has to happen, because if I don't, it's the end of the world. I'm going to put on weight. And how do I possibly make up for that tomorrow? I can't, because every moment of my day is already filled with my exercise. So it's to that degree that you could say I was completely owned by it. Absolutely everything was owned by it. And that's the imprisoning factor, because you go, well, how do I possibly move out of that? And there was a period there where I was starting to get more. It's not that I looked at myself and said, this has to stop. That wasn't the case, because that continued, those thoughts, this, you know, keep going. I couldn't see myself in reality. But the thing that did stop me was the torment factor, the torture factor. You know, I remember one day just crying, just nonstop crying, going, I can't do this anymore. I actually can't do this anymore. And it was at that point that I then reached out for help, as in I spoke to some friends around me and I said, this is what's going on and I just need help. I don't know what that looks like, because obviously I don't want to put on weight, but I can't live like this. And it was at that point that I started to get medical support. And on one level, that was very necessary, because my body was already starting to show signs that it was not doing well. Apart from the obvious, apart from how I was physically looking, there were things going on with my blood. You know, for example, the where I carried my handbag used to rub on my hip. And because all there was bone, it actually formed like a massive blood clot, like a blood lump under my skin, because you know, I couldn't even function on a basic level. Things were starting to show that this was serious. And I started seeing medical specialists at the hospital, and, you know, I was currently overseas, so they just said, okay, you know, here you go, here's your diet plan, here's what you need to eat. And I, because I had got to that breaking point where I said something needs to change, I was open to listening to what they had to say and what I needed to do. Had it been before that, there would have been no chance. I think you really need to get to that point where you say, okay, this has to stop. So I remember at that point, you know, I was being prescribed things like, okay, breakfast, eat this. Morning tea, eat this. Lunch, eat this. And for example, I remember my lunch requirement was something like a cup of pasta and an apple. And at that point, there was no way I could even eat an apple. There's no way my stomach could even have the capacity to eat an apple. And I did try, like, you know, and then I couldn't, there's no way I could eat a whole serve of pasta. Mm. This was not a reality. Although I gave it a go, but of course, you know, that just made me feel sick and bloated. And it really, that was challenging because I went, well, hang on, guys, like what are you asking for here? Because this actually is not a reality based on where I'm at.
One of my questions through this was, how much did the people around you really support you in part of your healing? Because it sounds like you were the one that came to that point that said, you know, I can't live like this anymore. But for people in the services that are supporting that, and, you know, maybe some nutritionists, naturopaths, dietitians would listen to this podcast, what you're saying to them is, could you please understand that when you're asking me to eat, because I see a lot of people who have, you know, that diet plan, and, you know, the parents are forced to feed that to their children or make them eat it, that actually it's not addressing the fact that your body is telling you that you can't eat it. Your head is telling you, yes, it's psychological, but your body is also saying, I have not consumed this amount of food, therefore my stomach has shrunk and my body can't process that quickly. So it's almost like when a body goes very cold, you have to incrementally heat it up to not put it into shock. I would say with this process, you can't just snap out of it. This is incremental as well, or is the incremental just pandering in some way? I'm not sure.
Well, it's interesting because I experienced both. In this case, in the hospital where I was, it was a little bit of, you know, okay, you just need to eat. You just need to snap out of it, and this is what you're going to eat. And as I said, I physically could not handle those foods and those quantities. There's just no way I could go from eating absolutely nothing to five or six meals a day, but they were substantial. Like, as I said, I couldn't even eat an apple. So that didn't work for me. I did find myself feeling sick. I couldn't digest. So there's no way that my body was able to handle that. And when it became clear to me that that wasn't going to work, I had also reached out to my family because they were back at home, and they insisted that I come home. And I didn't want to at first because I had my life set up over there, but I did then agree to come back to Australia. And of course, as soon as I got home, I was checked in, you could say, to a specialist medical clinic that specialized in eating disorders. And this was a different experience because the people I worked with did work on an incremental approach, which was very different. So, for example, we had a discussion and we agreed at the very beginning that I would trust the people I was working with. And, you know, there was a conversation there to say, look, we know you don't want to lose weight. We know you don't want to put on weight. However, we have to stabilize your body. And so in order to do that, this is what we're going to do. And we set up an eating plan that was incremental, that was essentially introducing food and introducing small meals, things that I could actually digest, things I could handle, to basically just stop me losing weight, which I was able to agree to at that point. And that also meant a cap on the exercise. Not that I couldn't exercise, but that it had to be, I had to limit it to 1 hour, which I struggled with. I did struggle with that a lot. So you could say on this level that physically then that supported me. I agreed in full with the diet plan. I didn't play games with that. I know that some people hide food and they, you know, they don't stick to it. And I would say that potentially that's because they haven't got to a point where they actually want to change. Whereas for me, it was a full, okay, this has to stop. And so therefore I was fully obedient to, okay, this is what I need to eat. That's what I'm going to eat. As I said, the point that I struggled with was the reduced exercise, because that's where the fear phobia would come in a bit, like, oh, shivers, you know, this could mean that I'm going to put on weight. And then I kept having, you know, I was basically having, I think I was there 3 to 4 days a week having regular check-ins and weigh-ins, but I wasn't allowed to see my weight. So I really had to work closely with them, with the team, to go with what we had agreed on, that this was not to put on weight. This was just to stabilize my body. And I had to keep coming back to that.
Really what we're talking about here is an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's an addiction to an excess and there's an addiction to a deficit, both of which appear, from what you're saying, to have the same outcome.
Yeah.
But would need, you know, you've got to increase one and decrease the other. But the addiction to the exercise also gives you, you know, a rush of endorphins. It gives you that dopamine hit. So there are, how did you compensate for that in your day to day? I'm just fascinated about how you did that for people who may be in that situation at the moment and going, wow, okay, you've literally walked in my footsteps. How can I learn from you?
I struggled with this part because, you know, everything had been consumed in full by the thoughts, right? Got to lose weight. Okay. You know, everything. Yep. I'm going to walk here. I'm going to go there after this. I'm going to do that. Everything revolved around that. So when that is removed to a certain extent, it became replaced with, okay, got to follow this meal plan. And there was a bit of, okay, you know, if in my meal plan it said at lunch I need to eat some fat-free yogurt, you know, and I'm going to the shops to buy my fat-free yogurt, I'm going to check all the different brands. I'm going to see which one has the least amount of sugar, or I'm going to have a look at all the different brands, because there's still that focus, has that energy has to go somewhere. And so there was that. But also I found that what then, you know, and for part of that period, I was also then at that clinic, you know, 3 or 4 days a week, they're giving me exercises, activities, so to speak, you know, we're having group discussions, I'm having meetings with psychologists and psychiatrists. So that takes up a certain amount of focus. But outside of that, I noticed then that the anxiety started to build, and I guess a level of depression, because it's like, well, what do I do now? Where do I go? What's my purpose? What's my focus? And, you know, this whole process where I was in this particular clinic went on for about, I would say around 2 years. And we went from that initial stage of stabilizing the body to then having a discussion of going, okay, look, we've stabilized the body. Now we need to start to put on a little bit of weight. We're not talking a lot. We're talking like 1 to 2 kilos. And I then agreed to that. And then the diet plan would change. So that, you know, that went on in various phases for a period of time. And I continued doing, you know, all the sessions that I needed to do there, the psychiatrist, all of that stuff, talking about various things that we did. And I remember, you know, looking at the girls there around me and going, wow, they're really sick. Like, because they were very withdrawn, you could say. They had, you know, they were just covering themselves up. And what I could see and feel was that there was nothing wanting to shift or change. But I could see very clearly the physical effects. And I was like, wow, they're really unwell. But I didn't see that in myself. And I remember, you know, one of the professionals there saying to me that, well, you know, you're actually far worse than any of the girls here. And I was a bit shocked by that because, you know, part of what had been running for me was this notion that, well, I'm really healthy because, you know, I don't eat much and I exercise a lot. So I'm actually very healthy. And I never hid my body in all of that process. You know, I'd still wear my bright, tight clothes and still wear my makeup, and I didn't see myself as sick. And during that whole time, you know, I would then go through these phases of, yep, okay, we have to change the plan. We've got to, you know, put on a bit of weight. And I would agree with that. But during the whole course of that, that period, I was finding that my anxiety was increasing and this sense of feeling lost because what do I do now? You know, I would fill my day. Like, how do I fill my day? I'm not even allowed to exercise and I'm not working. So what do I do? And essentially that's where I then started to look for something, you know. I started looking into study options. I was very into photography. You know, it's like I had to find something to put my focus to because the things that I had been doing were taken away. And so I was still in that period of being lost, you could say, until I actually reconnected with an old friend. And it was interesting because whilst, you know, the physical side, you could say, was starting to be taken care of by this program, the anxiety and the lack of settlement in myself hadn't been. That hadn't yet changed. I was still trying to find something, you know, I was still kind of floundering.
I hear what you're saying is that the doctors and specialists could deal with the outside and with the core, with the maybe the cause of the physical, but without addressing the lack of purpose, which is a word that you have used a lot here. The sport gave you purpose, the look gave you purpose. The look potentially was rewarded in your line of work or your experiences with the people around you. Certainly that oh, you've lost weight was, you know, food for fuel. But without having, once you had the exercise tailed, then what is my purpose really comes to the surface, and the anxiety of the lack of purpose in your life came to the fore.
Yeah. And, you know, when I look at it and go, okay, well, all of this really came from not feeling enough, not feeling good enough. And therefore I was relying on my physical body to be a certain way to fulfill that. And so when that's taken away, you know, all the anxiety comes up and there's this void from where you've been filling everything with those behaviors. So there's the void, there's the anxiousness, what's going to happen, but there's been nothing to build up something in myself that then doesn't require those behaviors at all. So there has to be the adjustment to the outside, definitely, but there also has to be something that builds you within, you could say, so you have something to stand on, because otherwise that void has got to be filled with something. And I see that that's the way that it plays out for a lot of people, that whilst, you know, there are some that say they've dealt with an eating disorder, you have to look at whether that has just been transferred to another area of life or another behavior or another platform to fill that gap. And so there was a bit of that going on for me, as in, okay, you know, trying to look for something to fill that gap. And it really wasn't until, as I said, I connected with this friend that I started to, it was like a confirmation or a sense in myself that, like a remembering that actually there is nothing wrong with me. And it's difficult to describe, you know, what that looks like necessarily, other than just like a deep, like just an ease in myself it took a bit of time, but started to feel like, wow, actually there's nothing wrong with me. There might be things in this world that are definitely not okay. There might be things going on around me, but this incessant need to fix something or that I'm not enough actually isn't the case. And with that came a, I guess, just a sense of ease. And it took time, definitely. This was not immediate, but that changed things for me a lot. And so then I would say the next stage was that I actually started to not just, you know, do the program, because I was still on that, but started to take care of myself in a different way, not from not being enough, nor needing to change something, but actually just being okay with who I was and nurturing that to a certain level, actually caring for myself on a certain level. And, you know, as simple as, you know, that whole period had been so much about overriding my body, everything. Like, your body's starving and you have to override it. You have to fight that. You have to ignore it to uphold what had been running. So a big part of this was actually listening to my body. So when
you know, like, for example, even if I was starving and I was exhausted, there's no way I would rest because that would have been an opportunity for me to get more exercise in. So during this whole process, when I started to, you know, actually listening to the body was a game changer. Like, oh, I'm tired. Okay, I'm just going to have a rest. Like that was a miracle because that had not happened for a long time. These small little things, actually looking after the body on that level, listening to the body, was huge.
The way you did that was, I mean, that sense of there's nothing wrong with me would be foundational, because for, I don't know how long that process that you've been in with this, getting the support has taken, but if you have spent the majority of your life thinking there was something wrong with you, to then go and have that confirmed by the medical profession because there genuinely now is something wrong with you, as you physically get back to a more stable space, the psychology of what you've been fed and consumed and really made your entire diet of the fact that there's something wrong with you, means that you start doubting your body. So to come back to that simplicity of listening to your body and trusting your body again, I'm sure you mentioned trust very early on in this interview. It feels like it's the person that you needed to trust the most to not let you down and to communicate truth with you was your body.
Yeah, absolutely. And everything about the way I had been living was fighting that. Everything, because you have to ignore everything your body's communicating. And so when I started to actually listen to my body and actually respond to it, that was huge. That was a massive change, you know, and I would say that's actually when I started to feel for the first time that I was freeing myself from it, from the eating disorder, because the physical changes, you know, like the changes I was making to food, the fact that my body was stabilizing, the fact that I was doing less exercise, that's all part of it, but that didn't allow me to feel free of it. Just eating food didn't make me feel free of it. Just exercising less didn't make me feel free of it, because my thoughts were still bombarded all the time and there was still that sense of not being enough. But it wasn't until I started then responding to the fact, like, you know, my body's tired, I don't have to go for a 2-hour run right now, I'm just going to have a rest, then I started to feel free of it, because I wasn't killing myself anymore. I wasn't punishing myself anymore. I wasn't overriding everything that I felt to have to go and do something else. And so, yeah, just having a rest or going, you know, okay, I feel like this now, and then responding to that, or, you know, just caring for my body in different ways. That's where I felt things really starting to shift. And that's when I started to actually, because that's a different kind of recovery, I started to actually feel a joy again, a freedom, an ease, like I was then taking the reins. And I wasn't at the mercy of this anymore. So that then, you know, was a process in itself for quite some time. And I would say, you know, it was probably from when I returned to Australia, it might have been about 4 to 5 years before I really started to feel that I was coming out of it. And there was a period, as I mentioned, with the anxiety, you know, there was a period there where I needed to get medication just to support me to handle that. Because at that point, you know, there was still the gap. I was changing the behaviors, but I hadn't filled the gap inside. So I needed some medical support there to be able to get through the levels of anxiety I was feeling. But as I then continued to fill the gap with these things, like starting to listen to my body as a start, starting to realize and work with the fact that there was nothing wrong with me and I was more than enough, and starting to see the things the way that I had seen the world, the way that I had basically the way I had been affected by things, the way I had you know, put things on myself that actually had nothing to do with me, or weren't necessarily the truth, so to speak, all along, and kind of built this case against myself, starting to unpackage that, then the anxiety and the need for the medication fell away. And coming out the other side of that is when I guess you could say I felt finally as though I was clear of it, because, you know, I'd done the steps of building the body, and I continued to do that, because once my body was stable and I completed the program at the eating disorder clinic, it was then over to me to have a relationship with food. And there was a period there where, you know, there was still that gap that I was working on. So the food stuff would be in and out. I'd build for a bit and then it'd drop. I'd build for a bit, then it'd drop. But the more that I then started to build myself, have that relationship with myself, listen to my body, and then start to eat according to my body, then there was a real stability. Then things started to take care of themselves, so to speak. Then I was able to exercise in a way that was not killing myself, because I have always loved exercise and there's nothing wrong with that. But I was able to then, for the first time, go for a walk and enjoy it. You know, go for a walk and enjoy it, and then go, oh, actually, yeah, time to turn around now. I don't have to push myself for another 2 hours. I can turn around now because that's enough. I don't have to, yep, okay, cool, I feel like having something for lunch. I don't have to now go for a run to burn it off. All of these sorts of things were how it started to look at the end of that. And from there, you could say that then, because the anxiety was easing, I could then actually start to get a bit clearer on my life and, okay, well, you know, work. Until that point, I hadn't been able to work. I had tried, you know, in the midst of my anxiety, I had tried because I just needed something to do. I just needed something to focus on. But, you know, people would take one look at me and there was no chance I was getting a job. So as, you know, the more I stabilized, the more I started to look after myself, things started shifting, and then I was able to start working, which was incredible. And that definitely gave me more purpose, more focus, and it helped me to you know, just open my eyes a bit and go, wow, you know, there are other people on this planet, not just me. Because, you know, you're so withdrawn in that whole process, everything becomes about you. You're so insular. It was very refreshing to be back out in the world and actually building relationships with people, actually interacting with people, and making things about things in this world that are not just me, but not just not about, that are not destructive.
Yeah, there's such a difference in your voice. There's a real lightness that comes into your voice when you talk about how you are now, but also how you work now. And the freedom, it sounds like, of not making it all about you, but with you being at the very core of what you can then bring to your work.
Yeah. And there has to be, that wouldn't have been possible earlier because of the lack of worth. You know, if, for example, if I had gone back to work in that, it would have been a constant, oh gosh, you know, am I going to stuff up? You know, it just would have been in that same pool of thoughts. But because there had, you know, I'd started to build a relationship with myself, it became really beautiful to then be able to go and value what I bring to other people, value what I bring to work, value what that actually means and the impact of what I was doing for other people. So that was actually a huge part of it also.
And may I also offer that a lot of the patterns of behavior, maybe your characteristics, we could use that word, that were destructive to you, could then flip to being probably some of your greatest strengths. So as you've been talking, I've just kind of made a note of a few. So you had great obedience. So that you were obedient to one master or another, right? And it sounds to me like the obedience to the master that you have now is to your body and to its communication and the joy that you are more obedient to now maintaining in your body. A level of commitment, which again, you can commit to one thing or another, but it sounds to me like your commitment to that absolute dedication to this is enough. I cannot live like this anymore. Really, that commitment to that deep stop moment was again what was the propulsion, the fuel that knew you were changing the source of your fuel. Then you had focus. You've used that word a lot, where you place your focus. Now, to me, it sounds like you can focus on the thoughts that are telling you you're rubbish and that you're a sinner or you're a bad or you're a failure or you're fat or you're thin or you're bloated or you're all of those words that come in that are based on failure or success, based on someone else's picture, but I might be throwing my thoughts in there, so I'll just pause that one. But you know, you can change the focus. You can change the what radio station you're dialing into. And then there's a dedication, which is the other word that you've used. It's like there were four things that really came through, so many of them were spoken about in a negative, but wow, when you change the focus, when you change the channel, it makes me feel quite teary at how they can be your greatest strength. I just can't appreciate enough, Kylie, just what you've offered in your lived experience and the fact that I can hear the joy, which means that the listeners would all be able to hear the joy in your voice just in this short interview.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with what you've shared, Lucy. You know, and when I look at my life now, it's true, like these qualities that were used or that I misused, you could say, are actually, they're things that are, yeah, definitely my greatest strengths. The way that I work now, you know, the way that I work, the way that I live, there is so much joy, but I I'm super consistent. And when there are things, for example, at work, or there are things that need to be done, I don't let things get in the way of that. There is an unwavering obedience to my body, the way, and I have to be that way to, I guess, sustain my role now, my work. My body has to come first. If I don't look after my body, if I don't listen to my body, I can't do what I do. And so there's actually, you know, I really look after my body deeply. And there is a great focus on what I then offer other people. And I have to take care of myself in order to be able to bring that. And so the bigger purpose, being stayed tuned to that channel, is how my life operates now. And when it remains like that, when everything is geared towards that bigger purpose, there's just no room for anything else to come in. You know, because you could say, well, why do you not get thoughts like you used to? Or how is there no entry point for that when it used to be my normal, it used to be my everyday? But everything about the way that I move now, the way that I live now, all of my choices are geared towards a bigger purpose, a bigger something that just leaves no speck for that to come in.
What a perfect way to complete this interview. Thank you so much, Kylie. I really appreciate the time that you have offered, the space that you have offered to walk us through a footprint of that others can follow if they so choose. And the most important part is it has to come from deep within you, because if you're doing it for someone else, or you're doing it out of the cycle that is ready and waiting for you, you're going to allow things through that perhaps take you back a couple of steps, which perhaps maybe is communication in itself.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Lucy.